Well, good evening and welcome to the first presentation in this, our ninth series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the white back there, Peggy Wright, with assistance from our webmaster, Haiwan Wan, walking around taking pictures, and our reference coordinator in the back, Brian Carson. Our technical specialist tonight is Daniel Pauly. Christopher McConnell and Daniel Peach designed our posters. Our speaker tonight is a native of Lexington, Kentucky, where she grew up as part of a large family. When she was young, she wanted to be a chemical engineer and was most influenced by her older sister. She became interested in food and nutrition when she met a friend in the chemistry lab who was majoring in dietetics. She's a food and nutrition graduate of the University of Kentucky and the Culinary Arts Management Program of Sullivan University's National Center for Hospitality Studies in Louisville, as well as a licensed dietitian in Kentucky and Ohio. As a personal chef, she cooked for over 100 private clients in the greater Cincinnati area, and later served as director of food service department for a retirement community, where she was responsible for preparation of daily meals for the 130 residents. Her love for cookbooks truly came home in 2000, when she began working for the Joy of Cooking Kitchen in recipe testing and development. And in 2004, her responsibilities shifted when she became a key member of the editorial staff for the 2006 edition. And she tells us that the 75th edition of the Joy of Cooking was unique because it resurrected important chapters on candy, frozen desserts, canning, and preserving, which had been cut in previous editions. As the owner of the Green Apron Company, a consulting firm specializing in culinary nutrition and cookbook development, she tests and develops recipes. She also serves on the Medical Advisory Board for Humana's Active Outlook Program, where she writes food nutrition content for their award-winning magazines. Her newest book, The Kentucky Fresh Cookbook, was published in 2011 by the University Press of Kentucky, and in it she organizes 200 recipes by season, incorporates Kentucky-grown and produced food, and gives helpful buying tips on everything from produce to wine, and even discusses the pros and cons of organic foods. Reviewers comment that she writes simple, clear, and seasonally appropriate recipes that are guaranteed crowd pleasers. Many of her recipes incorporate Kentucky's most famous beverage, and her banana bourbon walnut French toast and bourbon mint slushies are but two examples. She even gives you tips on how to grill fish or butterfly and split a whole chicken. In between, there's lots of good home tales and sage advice. It's a real pleasure to welcome Maggie Green to talk about seasonal cooking in Kentucky. Maggie?
Every time somebody reads that about me, I can't believe it's me, because what I've done with this cookbook is really probably what I was supposed to do 25 years ago or wanted to do, but isn't it funny the path we take to get to where we are today? Like Ryan said, I grew up in Kentucky, grew up in Lexington, now live in Northern Kentucky, so Kentucky has been my home for over 40 years, and I love the state. And when I got asked by the University Press to write a cookbook, they originally suggested a Southern cookbook. And I said, let me think about that. And I went home and I thought, you know, I could write a Southern cookbook, but really, but you often are told to write about what you know. The best books are written, especially nonfiction, by people who know their subject inside and out. And I had kept this, like, side journal of all these things I had been cooking at home for a couple of years. So I encourage any of you who are journalists or, you know, write things like journals and keep notes, keep track of things, because you never know. But I drew on the 2 years of my recipes that I had written down, what I had been cooking at home in my own home, and came up with the idea for the proposal, originally titled 1 Year in My Kentucky Kitchen. And I guess the first thing I might say about cookbook publishing or any book publishing is usually the title the author wants is not typically what the book ends up being. The marketing department at the University Press, who is actually an excellent publisher to work with, they're based in Lexington, they thought it needed a more catchy title, and I've come to learn that cookbook titles with less than 5 words are easy to say, easy to remember, and the Kentucky Fresh Cookbook is what they came up with. but it is a 12-month journey through a Kentucky year. My theory is that people ought to cook all year round for health reasons, for economical reasons. There's a lot of great benefits to cooking at home, and I think it ought to be all year round, thus the tie-in to seasonal cooking. Because we know in Kentucky we have four very distinctive seasons, spring, summer, winter, and fall. So we'll start talking a little bit about seasonal cooking in Kentucky. It's great to be back in Bowling Green. I was here in April for the Southern Kentucky Book Fest. That was actually before the book was even released on Amazon. So I was really here almost pre-pub, but not quite. But it was a great time, and that's how I met Brian, and he invited me to come tonight. Let's talk a little bit about our global food supply. You know, we hear so much, and sometimes in a negative way, everything's global these days. You know, it's all global, and gosh, isn't it terrible? It's global. Well, I have to tell you, there's really two sides to this global story when it comes to food. The first side is that we do have an abundance of food, typically cheap and inexpensive food, that has contributed to an obesity epidemic for sure in our state, in our nation, and now it's even moving to countries that are becoming more westernized. Food is cheap, it's abundant, and especially when it comes to fast food and things like that. That's one side of the global equation for the problem of our obesity epidemic. The second thing, though, is that without global transportation, food supply, all these things, you know, we may not be able to, we've got a long way to go with world hunger, but we wouldn't be able to do the things that we're doing if we couldn't get the food to where it needs to go. So I just encourage you to try to, we talk about food processors, food manufacturers, and we couldn't all eat as well as we're eating today without them. We don't all have victory gardens. I live outside of an agrarian lifestyle. I don't have a huge garden. I have this little pot of herbs on my patio, and I say in my book some sad tomato plants and pepper plants. And I don't farm, and I don't have a huge garden. So what would I do if it wasn't for the people that are, you know, doing it for us? But that's what this book came from, was that I really wanted to speak to people who live outside of that lifestyle. I'm sure you've all heard of the book. If you haven't, it's a good read. Animal Vegetable Miracle by Barbara Kingsolver. She's a Kentucky author. She lived in Arizona, moved to a family farm in Virginia, and decided she would embark on an experiment for 1 year and only eat things that they grew in their own farm or raised or bought within a 100-mile radius of where they lived. So that automatically eliminated a lot of things for her, and she didn't realize it until she started on the experiment. Sugar, lemons, olive oil, all these things that, you know, weren't available from this 100-mile region. And I loved her book. I read it in 2007, but for me, working, raising a family, and trying to eat quote-unquote healthy, seasonal, local, fresh, whatever you want to call it, I couldn't do that because it was an awful lot of work. If you've read the book, by the time February rolls around, I mean, she's almost in a panic wondering if they're going to have enough food with what they put up from the summertime to feed them all winter long. So the seasonality of food, you know, in the global part of food in her book did inspire me to do this. So, but I don't want us to think that this global transportation of food and stuff is really necessarily a bad thing. But there is some food policies that do make it hard on small to mid-sized farms. We do know that about global food systems. And also, everybody's concerned, and they should be, about chemicals that from conventionally raised produce that pollute our water and harm our topsoil. I heard a speaker at the American Dietetic Association convention a couple years ago that said a country is only as strong as the condition of its topsoil. And as it stands right now, a lot of it's washing down the Mississippi River into the Gulf Basin. And I think people are really starting to try to become aware of this to keep the topsoil where we grow our crops healthy. Now, when it comes to cooking, you can't cook for fresh ingredients unless you've shopped for ingredients and gotten them into your home. So cooking really involves planning, shopping, cooking, and cleanup. And I always tell the story when I was first married 24 years ago, my husband and I lived in Michigan for about 2.5 years. And we had this arrangement. I plan the meals and he cooked. I plan the meals He shopped, he cooked, and I cleaned up. There's really four parts to, you know, having that. Now, I plan, I shop, I cook, and he cleans up. So it's funny how these different things, but when you think about cooking at home, you do have to address all four of those, and the shopping is the part that I'm going to talk specifically about tonight. I don't think you can eat well without some sort of a plan, but when it comes to shopping, I think we're very confused. And sometimes I even still get confused. Am I going to eat seasonal? Am I going to eat local like Barbara Kingsolver did and eat only local food? Or am I going to buy everything organic? So what is local? Well, the USDA has tried to help us define this. And a recent Federal Register just published in February of 2011. There's a lot of words there, but the thing that you should remember is they're saying 400 miles from the origin of the product. So I got my map out and I measured 400 miles from here. You say, let's just say central Kentucky, western. It goes far south as Atlanta. As far west is a little further west than St. Louis. North to north of Detroit, and then east to Charlottesville, Virginia. So if you think of that circle as being, that's how they would define a local product in this area. Because the problem they're running into is that people are calling things local, kind of like they call food natural, but what does it really mean? So now the USDA thankfully has defined it as 400 miles. Some people would say that's too far. Some people in Bowling Green would say, well, I really want to try to eat all my produce in the summertime from Bowling Green, and that's only maybe 5 miles. Okay, what's organic? Organic is big business. It does not imply small, quaint family farm, as evidenced by the organic Batter Blaster pancake mix in the can. I bought it about 2 weeks ago, and I brought it home with a half a gallon of Trough chocolate milk. Trough is a locally produced chocolate milk. They're closing their production factory in northern Kentucky, so I thought, we'll have one last half gallon of Trough chocolate milk. So I set it on the counter, and I got the Batter Blaster out, and my kids looked at me and said, what are we doing? I said, we're having a local organic meal. Now, my point is, you can do that without having anything fresh, okay? And this sells at Kroger for about $4.50. But it's organic. So you hear people say, I eat only organic food. But to me, that doesn't really mean a lot because it could be organic cereal bars. It could be the Batter Blaster. It could be Fruit Puff cereal that you can buy at Whole Foods that's organic. You see, I mean, it goes on and on and on. So don't let the organic word make you think that it's small, quaint family farm. Organic is now big business. And I'm sure, and the flip side of that, though, is that they're treating hopefully the land better, and maybe it's a more sustainable way. But I don't think this is what most people have in mind when they think about organic food. So what is seasonal? Well, and this is where my book heads, is that in the back I put a Kentucky produce chart, and I specifically included the months of January, February, March, November, and December. Sometimes produce charts will lop those months off the charts. It starts in April and ends in November. But if you look in the back of my book, it's all blank pretty much on those months. So seasonal produce in Kentucky, if you eat seasonally here at Bowling Green, you're almost guaranteed if you're buying it from somebody that raises it here. You know, tomatoes are in season, I'm going to buy them from Kentucky. Chances are they're going to be local. When strawberries are in season, you can buy them at Kroger still. Doesn't always mean that they're local, though, because strawberries come from, you know, California primarily. But a lot of times with seasonal food, if you're really shopping at a farmer's market, you can take the stretch that point seasonal means local. Seasonal food is not available year-round within a region. So here in Bowling Green, tomatoes are not available year-round. Corn's not available year-round. Beans aren't available year-round. And we enjoy them when they're here. I've often said in food we've lost the meaning of the word anticipation. And I write a food column for a little newspaper that's published in Northern Kentucky, and that's kind of what I talked about last month, is we've kind of lost the meaning of that word of waiting for certain foods to come in season. You can find anything you want year-round in a supermarket, but really the anticipation and waiting for really good local asparagus or really good strawberries. And asparagus always come to mind to me because that's like one of the first vegetables that you get in the springtime. And I think it's worth waiting for. Defined by a geographic area, not a nation or a country. Like I said, it's usually a regional thing when you're talking about seasonal and the benefits of seasonal foods. Plant diversity. If people are growing things here locally, if you look at the nationwide big industrial corn growers, they probably have a very limited number of species or varieties of corn that they're growing. If it's grown locally by local farmers, they can change up the types that they're growing. They can grow different varieties of tomatoes. You've probably heard about heirloom tomatoes. They're very popular. And with a more diverse population of plants, they're less susceptible to disease, pests, and weather. If you have one or two strains of corn, one or two strains of tomatoes that make it into the supermarkets, if a pest hits that one and attacks that one kind, you can see it could be devastating for the whole crop all across the country. So plant diversity is really a backdoor reason to eat seasonally and then try to support people who grow seasonal foods in your area because of this plant diversity issue. I don't think anybody would argue that seasonal food is more tasty and flavorful. The statistics show that fruits and vegetables spend 7 to 14 days in transit to go to supermarkets. Locally grown produce or seasonal produce is usually sold within 48 hours after harvest. So that's a difference of, you know, anywhere from 5 to 12 days, which makes a difference. The other thing that makes a difference is that they can leave it on the vine longer, leave it on the tree longer, and that helps to increase the ripeness and the flavor as well. Things that are shipped to supermarkets have to be picked maybe a little bit earlier for transportation reasons. They're not as soft and maybe won't bruise as easily. Food safety. 3 weeks ago, there was a recall of 36 million pounds of ground turkey from a Cargill plant in Arkansas. And that one plant, you know, had shipped ground turkey to 7 or 8 states. The ground turkey from our Kroger in Northern Kentucky was affected, you know, and it's funny because when I was shopped the next week, at the bottom of the receipt it said, you have purchased ground turkey that was affected by the recall. So it's interesting how they were able to track through my little shopper card that I was one of the people that had the turkey. So go home, throw it all out. Now in a small, in a seasonal, localized food environment, if I'm buying turkey from Brian and he raises turkey and he grinds it himself, if there's a problem, it affects a very few people compared to, you know, big, especially meat. I tend to try to buy my meat more local, people grinding it local rather than the ground turkey. And that just really drove that point home with me. But it is a safer food system. But again, you're still up against the wall with, you know, without this big food system, we can't feed a lot of people that need to be fed. But we have to be sure that food safety is a number one priority with large food and produce producers. We knew about the spinach outbreak, you know, there's outbreaks of salmonella and peanut butter. And the thing that bothers me about that is that's not a food that anybody would cook anyway. You know, it's, you open a jar of peanut butter, spread it on a piece of toast, and to think that it's contaminated with salmonella and you don't even get a chance to cook it. So I think food safety is of utmost importance, and maybe that's my nutrition background and my, you know, coming through, but I think that by and large it's, we're in pretty good shape, but a more seasonal, localized, decentralized food system probably can help contain a problem a little bit better. The environment, a lot of people eat seasonally because of environmental issues. If for not nutritional reasons, no taste, they don't care about the food safety, the environment, it travels less distance from the farm to the table. There's less effects of fuel and packaging. And there's 56 miles for local produce versus 1,494 miles for conventional produce, according to a study done at Iowa State University. So that's how far the food would actually travel, local versus conventional. And nutrition. Now, if I was sitting here talking to a whole group of dietitians, some might work for the canned food industry, frozen food industry, some might represent the Apple Board. I'm sure there'd be big debate. But food that's allowed to ripen longer on the tree or on the vine could have more nutritional value than some that's not. So that's where the more nutritious argument comes from. There's also studies done by the Organic Research Center that says that organic produce that's raised without conventional chemicals has higher antioxidant value for their fruits and vegetables. the research and the stuff that they talk about is, you can access it all online. So I think it's kind of moving in this direction, but as a whole, the nutrition community is not all on board with those thoughts, one for one. The other thing that I think seasonal, and eating seasonally for me anyway, and one benefit is, you know, your farms are vital. You have a strong economic system with those farms, and it strengthens your region. And here in Bowling Green, there's 3 farmers markets. I'm sure they're pretty busy. If you go to the farmers markets on a Saturday morning or the other days that they're open, you actually get to talk to people. You get to talk to people who are growing your food. And the local community around a farmers market is an exciting place. So I think that only serves to make things stronger. Farmers markets are on the rise, so much so that it's even becoming difficult to find enough farmers to come and back up their truck to sell their produce. Okay, so that's a little, now we're going to talk a little bit about more into the nuts and bolts of how to do this. And of course, I talk about it a lot in my cookbook, but just a few thoughts about how to eat more seasonally. All right, seasonal food replacements. One thing I recommend people do is develop a sort of list of things that can be replaced with a seasonal alternative. For example, corn in the summertime, a starchy vegetable, you might replace it with potatoes in the winter. You don't have to eat corn year-round. You can replace it with something else for wintertime. Green beans in the summer, if you can them or you freeze them, you can, of course, eat those in the winter, but you could replace a green vegetable like that with something like a more hearty green, like kale or something that grows in the colder seasons. Strawberries, of course, are a fruit that are available in the springtime, and those can really be replaced through the end of apple season with, if you start with strawberries, peaches, apples. Apples can be stored in your home. So try to think of seasonal foods as not year-round food. Again, the anticipation of waiting for these foods to come in season, and then trying to enjoy the corn when it's here, and then you can maybe have a replacement for it in the wintertime. And I'm talking about fresh rather than buying fresh corn in the produce department at a supermarket. I keep bags of frozen corn in my refrigerator. I'm sure probably most, a lot of you might, you know, do that as well. But what I'm talking about with these replacements is the fresh replacement. Rather than eating strawberries in January, you know, we can eat apples and things that really are more in season that time of the year. Johns Hopkins University came up with Meatless Monday, a theory of this was all from trying to eat less meat for health reasons and for benefits to our environment. Cows on feedlots supposedly produce a lot of methane and greenhouse gases, so there's really 2 reasons. But seasonal Saturday is an idea that you can incorporate, and that makes it easy because if you really make Saturday your one meal where you really try to eat things seasonally, it's typically associated with the day that the farmer's market is open in the morning. So seasonal Saturday might work for you and your kitchen. Also, knowing where your food comes from, you can check labels of origin. You can ask your farmer where it comes from. And I put a paragraph here at the bottom about something called Harvest Mark. I don't know if you've seen it on fresh produce, but there's a code, a Harvest Mark code on a lot of packaged fresh produce. Like, say you buy a bag of broccoli slaw or chopped cabbage, romaine lettuce that's already been cleaned. You can put the code for Harvest Mark, go to theharvestmark.com, put the code in, and it will tell you when it was packaged and where it was packaged. So they're really tracking this movement of produce from where it starts to where it ends up, if you really are interested in knowing more about where it's actually coming from and how old it is. The other thing that goes along with seasonal cooking is cooking methods change. I don't think very many people grill in the winter. Ethan Becker, the co-author of Joy of Cooking, always told me a story, though, about a friend of his. It was a gentleman who lived alone, and he grilled all year round. And he says in the wintertime, you just see this hand, like, emerge from the sliding door. And then he'd flip the steak, and then he'd pull his hand back in. You know, his grill was always in use all winter long on his patio. Now, that's not typical. But a funny story about how someone enjoyed the cooking method, and they'd do anything to ensure that their food is cooked that way. I've preheated the oven twice in the past couple of days, and I know the reason why is because it's gotten cooler outside. And I roasted a piece of pork last night, and we've done some roasted carrots in the oven, and we weren't doing that in the summertime. It's too hot. We have air conditioning, but it's still too hot. It heats up the kitchen, and we were doing grilling outside, making salads, eating fruits that were cold and just washed. So explore different kinds of cooking methods, and put old, you know, the grilling can go away for the wintertime, and you can do other cooking methods in the wintertime. Stewing, braising, roasting, baking are all more in winter and fall activities. So it's really a year-round endeavor if you get right down to seasonal cooking. Not only looking at your produce and what's in season, but then also the whole idea of trying to change your cooking methods and that are actually more applicable to the season. Is this propping anything up? No. Okay. The book itself, I was going to show you this. I had seen several produce charts put out by the Extension Office, and so I did the produce chart, and like I was talking about, the January through March sections, the columns are pretty much empty. But I did vegetables, fruits, and herbs, because cooking with fresh herbs seems to be, well, I know from, you know, I've always heard about it as a nutrition professional, that's a great way to reduce sodium, add flavor without adding salt. But a lot of people are cooking with fresh herbs, so it was interesting for me to do kind of a little bit of research about when these herbs are really in season. And the most interesting one is that cilantro is a cool weather herb. It bolts in the summertime, which means it goes to seed. You very rarely will have a good, juicy red tomato growing at the same time your cilantro is growing. The tomatoes like heat, they like a lot of sunshine, and if you do that to cilantro, it isn't going to work here in the Kentucky area. The cilantro bolts. So I'm always interested why those two are paired together. There must be some climates where they pair together. Here in Kentucky, basil and tomato are more complementary. And of course, they taste very good together. But I also included an herb chart because I use a lot of fresh herbs in my cooking and thought that might be beneficial for someone who's perhaps trying to do more fresh herbs in their diet. The cookbook cover, in any cookbook project, there's no photography in this book. And a lot of, that's, I think, been one of the criticisms of the book, but of course we knew this going into it, was that there's no photography. Some people can't cook unless there's a picture of the recipe so they can see what it is. But there's a style of books that we were going after to mimic that. The University Press did a nice two-color interior, and they used a local Kentucky artist to do pictures throughout the chapters, and then this beautiful cover of ingredients sitting on a kitchen table ready to be cooked. And their name is Cricket Press. It's a young couple in Lexington. But a very unique approach to a book. They did an original paperback. Hopefully it's something that you can lay easy on the counter, opened up. A cookbook that's definitely meant to be used and not placed on a coffee table. Seasonal cooking is not always organic, and it's not always local. But I think that, in my opinion, it's one of the best ways to become a cook that, you know, uses your kitchen year-round. And certainly something for us all to strive for. And it's not always possible for me, easy for me. I mean, you know, there's times when I just go to Kroger and, you know, anything I see that I think I want to cook, we put in the basket. But it's definitely a new way to think about food, and it ties us to the local food scene, I think, better than a lot of other ways that we could think about food. And for me, that's been an exciting part of this project. Cookbook print sales just in general are up 6% year to date from last year to this year. So cookbook print sales compared to electronic devices are still very strong. So I'm always hoping that means it's a resurgence or maybe some interest in doing more things in the kitchen, people cooking more for themselves. And the New York Times just ran an article last weekend about possibly bringing home economics classes and cooking back to high schools, because it's a life skill that definitely is something that is beneficial for people, you know, for their whole life, the ability to cook. And I was talking to Julie when we were at dinner earlier, and she's teaching a cooking class, a basic cooking course here at Western, and I think some of the people come in without a lot of those skills, don't they?
trouble with like willing waterless.
Right. So I'm open to questions. I can talk a little bit more about the cookbook in too, but I'm really interested too in what you guys might have questions about if anybody has anything they'd like to ask it.
Yes. I have a daughter and her husband who do a lot of organic cooking, and I've mentioned to her in our library, it said choose your organic things. Some of them are so expensive.
Exactly.
And it said pick out certain things.
There's a what she is saying is about organics can be expensive. There is a list of produce called the Dirty Dozen in the Clean 15, and it's updated every year by the Environmental Working Group. And if you have a limited food budget, and if you don't want to buy all your produce organic, they tested for pesticide residue, and these top 12 fruits and vegetables had the highest amount of pesticide residue. So I always tell people, you can kind of put your money toward the organics for these. And the top three this year were apples, strawberries, and celery, which was interesting to me. And that Clean 15 then, at the bottom of the list, it doesn't make sense to buy organic unless you just have to say it's all organic, but it was things like bananas, avocado, corn. Most of the time they had some sort of covering or coating that you really weren't eating. But that's one way to try to budget your food dollars, organic versus conventional. You need to talk to your farmers when you buy food locally, because you can't always assume that it's organically grown, even if it's local. Organic is a certification, and maybe they haven't gotten that far. They may not use chemicals, but you can ask people if you're really interested, you know, when you shop, if it's if you're using chemicals or not. And they should be open to having a conversation about it. And I always say, if they get really defensive and don't want to talk about it, there's probably a reason. Yes.
The other day, NPR on Fresh Air was talking about bananas.
I heard that interview. That guy wrote a book called Banana, didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it was so interesting, and he mentioned, I can't remember what the exact statistics were, but we eat something like, Americans eat something like 15 pounds of bananas a year, and the average in the rest of the world is something like, it is like hundreds and hundreds of pounds a year, because it's the main staple in so many countries.
Yeah. And the other thing that's interesting about bananas is, you know, again, if you talk about truly eating local, 400 miles local, I mean, are we going to eat bananas? No. I often wonder too, someone told me once, the story of, you know, Kentucky foodways and how bananas made it into our food culture, because banana pudding and pineapple upside down cake are not new recipes. You know, they've been around in Kentucky cooking for a while. And those two things are quote unquote tropical. And I always find it fascinating that those, you know, that's not local cooking.
Kentucky
was a train station.
That's where they changed off.
And that a lot of it came in that way. Yeah. I was somewhere last week and someone mentioned the name of that town specifically.
We're from West Kentucky.
Yeah. Right. You know, my mother always talks about in Lexington around Christmas, the train coming into Lexington with the grapefruit. But see, that's what I mean by anticipation. They loved the day when the grapefruit showed up, and they looked forward to it, and they ate it when they had it, and then it was over. And fruit, growing up in the neighborhood my mother did, it's very interesting. You know, they had rhubarb, which is really not a fruit, but it's the vegetable grown as a eaten as a fruit. Then they only had fruit that people grew on trees in the neighborhood. And some people grew grapes, and of course there were blackberries. But you know, fresh fruit was not as prevalent in their diets, except during the summertime. Yes?
Do you do a lot of food preservation yourself?
No. I do some things. There's some things I do every year. I have a recipe for freezer pickles. I usually make those and put them in the freezer. And then also like a chili relish type thing. I do that at the end of the year. I just go to the farmer's market and buy a box of canner tomatoes. Some of them have, you know, splits, or they may not be as pretty as the ones that are in the basket in the front, and I make a batch of that. But not for the fall and winter, for our family to be sustained on. See, and that's what Barbara Kingsolver did, is she worked, September was like, she worked day and night to store food so that they could eat. Because they had that 100 mile, there's not going to be anything growing. Yeah. It's making a resurgence, though, canning and preserving.
I love it.
Yeah. Brian. You do both boiling water and pressure canning? Yeah.
After.
Yep.
I'm going to do it.
Have you?
Peach jelly that nobody's ever heard of. Can't find a recipe for sugar-free peach jelly anywhere.
Did you make one up?
No. Chicken. Try it without. Yeah.
No, I think.
I want to use the packet of just the peach juice.
Right.
But, you know, I don't know how much Splenda to put in there, so.
Yeah.
I didn't
want to
waste my
ingredients. Right. Canning, I think one reason it's a resurgence, too, is there's this whole theory with some younger people, too, that they need to learn to do these things in case they're ever in a situation where they have to feed themselves completely, you know. So that's one of the reasons it's becoming popular. Plus, you know what food's in the jar, and I think for reasons of economy.
I can control the salt better.
Yeah.
How do you go about testing recipes? Do you have a,
testing recipes.
Yes.
Testing recipes is, I did a dietitian wrote a cookbook called Preventing a Second Heart Attack last year, and she wanted to do all the science part, but she was dreading the part about the recipes. So she said, Maggie, if you come up with 25, I've got 25 from these chefs in these restaurants I know, and we'll have 50 recipes in the back of this book. So, what you have to do when you test recipes, though, is you have to... So, the testing is from the recipes the chef sent me, I had to test it in my own kitchen. That's called a test. Okay, so Chef Jay Albertson from Florida sent me a recipe for a pan-seared salmon with a saffron broth or whatever. He wrote it out, and I had to test it. Okay, so if it works, fine. If it doesn't work, hopefully the tester has a little bit of editorial control and can insert comments or let the author know what to write in the manuscript to change it. If it's a total failure and it doesn't work, you have to kind of go back to the drawing board. Go to the author, say to her, this didn't work, and we need to get a revamp on the recipe. The development piece of it is different, though. Janet would say, I want to have a flatbread, like whole wheat flatbread thing that you buy at the store, what they call globally, with this pizza crust. And make it with arugula and tomatoes. And she told me what she wanted on it, and then I had to develop the recipe to meet her specifications. So there's really two parts to, and the best recipe testers are not the author, and not the person that wrote the recipe. The best tester is somebody else, a home cook, who can cook in their kitchen and see if the recipe really works. It's a great job. You know, she paid me to do the work, and she bought the groceries, and guess who got to eat everything? We ate everything, and then she required a digital photo sent to her so she could see it cooked, and then also test notes. I would say, this is really good, you might change this or that, and that's how we did it. Now, the testing for this book, I had people that helped me test the recipes for this, in particular if there are things that I had questions about or trouble with. I would just, you know, you can send a recipe in the email to your neighbor down the street or your sister that lives in Frankfurt, and you say, please, can you make this cake? Tell me what you think. They weren't paid like I was to do the other one. But, and that's kind of a bone of contention with cookbook authors, whether you pay your testers, whether testers should be expected to be paid. Kind of depends on if it's a part of their work or just a hobby. Shirley Carrier wrote Bakewise, and I helped her edit that book, and I think she paid her testers maybe $25 a recipe for baking, all baking recipes. Yes.
One thing I thought about when you were talking about strawberries, how the strawberries now come from California.
Right.
Of course, Warren County at one time was the number one producer in the nation of strawberries, and we have hardly any now. And I'm kind of wondering
what exactly happened. I don't know what would happen unless
it's too late.
She said too labor intensive.
Same thing happened in Paducah, our hometown. Strawberry.
And it must have had the right climate and the right kind of soil to grow and support the strawberries.
You can only harvest so many years.
I think what happens with farming too, big scale farming, is certain things become more profitable than others. And it's about, you know, farming's about making money and earning a living. You're going to want to raise what brings you the most, you know, income onto your farm and for your family. And in California, I'm sure the strawberry farms are just, you know, massive operations, big.
Peggy, back in.
sort of an academic question, though. Was it fast foods that made high schools no longer have the food program in the high school? And if that is true, how many people really cook at home anymore to bring that back to high schools?
Right. I think it's a catch-22. I don't know that we can say that fast food restaurants, you know, caused the decline of... I think that high schools probably are under a lot of pressure, too, to make sure that their students are up to snuff to be ready for college. And, you know,
it's expensive to set up a kitchen.
There's also kind of a movement it's called slow food.
Yeah, slow food movement. Right, and I
didn't hear
the slow food movement. You know, the other thing is we live in the information age now and not the industrial age. I mean, that's a given fact. And I think that schools are really, and I was just telling the people I went to dinner with, the high school my son goes to replaced their library with a technology center. So they're really focusing on the information age and their ability to operate as college students and beyond in the information age. And cooking, and even for women, and I come from a family of eight. I'm the fifth girl of seven girls, so I've got four sisters older than me. And they can think of every reason in the world why they don't want to cook. They're too busy to cook. They're too liberated to cook. They don't have time to cook. They got beautiful kitchens, but there's no action. I talk about that a lot. Now, there's not anybody in there doing anything. You know, and I think that cooking has to really meet people at some sort of a value level for whatever it is. And if it's all of a sudden you have kids and you think, well, I got to feed my kids better, that's good motivation to cook. For you, if it's canning because you can control what you put in your food and you can keep track of it. If it's to have dinner party once a week with your neighbor, you know, your friends. And the slow food movement, it's just kind of a backlash from doing everything so fast and so quick. And it's enjoyment of food and cooking at that level. So why there was the sharp decline and what's it going to take to get home ec cooking back, I don't know. But I always say I can hire someone to wash my clothes, vacuum my rugs, cut my grass, all those, you know, whatever. I can buy clothes, I don't have to sew them, but none of those directly impact my health. Food and what I put into my body and what I eat, what I feed my kids, how we eat as a family, how we eat as a neighborhood, that makes a difference in the health of Kentucky. You know what I mean? What's the statistic they're predicting in 2020? 50% of Americans are going to be obese? A lot of people would say the nutrition problems are really a cooking problem.
We have time for one more question. You might tell us when you became first, a distinction when you began working with Joy of Cooking.
Brian asked me at dinner, how did you get to work with the Joy of Cooking? Well, the Joy of Cooking story started in 1931 with a widowed woman named Irma Rombauer whose husband committed suicide. And she had to have a way to earn money. And she was not a particularly good cook, but she was a very good baker, and she knew a lot of people that were good cooks. So she collected all these recipes, self-published the first edition of the Joy of Cooking. 1931, they printed 3,000 copies. So if anybody comes up to us at a book signing and says, I have an original Joy of Cooking, Ethan will always say, is it a little blue book? Oh, no, no, it's got this kind of aqua cover and it's this big. And what he says, he said, well, that's the original book to you, but the one grandma, I think he told her grandma, was 1931. Little, small trim size, the binding, not the binding, the casing on the book is navy. Gold letters. Then in 1936, it was picked up by a publisher, Bob's Merrill. They were based in Indianapolis. And the story goes that every 10 years, a new Joy of Cooking was published and revised. So Ethan is in his mid-60s, was born and raised in Cincinnati, and I met him at a fundraiser. We got paired together to work at this fundraiser. And he's a great cook, but not a very good recorder of things, and I told you about my recording project and what came out of that. So his wife said, Maggie, come cook with Ethan and write down everything that he puts in the pot. And we'd make a recipe, but then we'd have to test it, right? Make sure that it worked. And that's how I met Ethan. They have since moved to Tennessee, But I did a lot of heavy lifting in the 2006 revision of Joy of Cooking. It's the one with the big red dot on the front. And it was a very interesting project. Now, Irma wrote recipes in the action method, which means the ingredients are called for at the time that they're used, and that was to save space. Ethan always said he'd sit at the dinner table and his parents would talk about space, and space this and space that. And as an eight-year-old, he'd think rockets. And as about the cookbook, you know, is there's enough room in the book for all the stuff that they wanted to put in. So
the old one that I have is that thick. There is an awful lot of reading.
There's a lot of reading, and when Irma wrote, people said you felt like she was there in the kitchen. And then Marion, his mother, Ethan's mother, was a little more intellectual and had a very strong nutrition bent. And a lot of her writing, too, was done by Ethan's father, John. They worked together as a team on the revisions of the books from the 60s, 75, and then they didn't do a book in the 80s. So really, the 1975 was the last book that Ethan's mother was actually involved in. Yeah, that's big business publishing. Their publisher is in New York, and a completely different experience than working with University Press. Although I have to say that, you know, I had some knowledge about what it took to get a cookbook done. And I also know that there's people who run the contract to write cookbooks for certain publishers. They just never get the manuscript done. I mean, it's an incredible amount of work, but The Joy of Cooking is, of course, one of the best selling American cookbooks. I think there's 18 million copies in print.
Again, on behalf of our friends organization from WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum and our congenial hosts at Barnes & Noble, we want to thank Maggie Green for driving all the way down Cincinnati to chat with us. We're going to set up a table back here if you'd like to get a copy of her book. I'm sure she'll be glad to autograph it. We hope you'll join us in October in this series when we'll have Robert Dickey, former lawyer to Charles Garvin in town, who will be here to talk about his new book, Greyhound to Vegas, The Odyssey of Hilda Reynolds Krause. It's a fascinating story. Next week, we'll be here in our other joint series, Faraway Places, and our first speaker up will be medical anthropologist Erin Koch from the University of Kentucky, who will be talking about her experience dealing with tuberculosis victims in Georgia. So, fascinating talk next week. So, again, thank you so much for coming out, and hope to see you next week or next month. Good evening.